Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's program, now that President Obama has visited the Valley, pledging his administration's support to help California get through its drought, what's next for the Golden State? We'll talk to our local political experts. Also on our program today, you've heard all about the expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act through Covered California, the state's insurance exchange. But there's another part to the health law, the Medi-Cal expansion. We'll get an update on how it's going in Fresno County. We'll also find out why the California Department of Fish and Wildlife is banning fishing in many rivers across the state. That and a look at a new silent film series taking place at downtown Fresno's Warner's Theater and more, all next on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero. According to California officials, there's plenty of money available to abide by a federal court order requiring the state to reduce its prison inmate population. Capital Public Radio's Max Pringle reports.
A three-judge panel granted California a two-year extension last week to comply with a federal order to reduce prison overcrowding. The current state budget sets aside $315 million for that purpose. Governor Jerry Brown's budget proposal for the next fiscal year adds another $400 million to prison population reduction. H.D. Palmer with the governor's Department of Finance says the money would have been spent differently had the court not granted the extension.
Then the money we are providing for things such as mental health, substance abuse disorder, reentry programs, we would have had to have spent that money to acquire additional out-of-state capacity to house inmates.
Meanwhile, a recent study from the nonprofit watchdog group, the California Budget Project, says prison spending is up about $1 billion over what it was 2 years ago and went mainly to guard salaries and housing inmates. At the state capitol, I'm Max Pringle.
The California Republican Party may be feeling more optimistic after winning some big local races. Katie Orr reports from Sacramento.
California Republicans may not hold any statewide offices, but they're picking up steam on the local level. Recent elections saw the GOP take the mayor's office in San Diego and capture the mayor's office and two city council seats in San Bernardino. GOP political consultant Mike Madrid says the wins provide some much-needed positive news for the party.
Even though there may be a brand problem with Republican candidates, there is an emerging group of candidates that can occupy the center and be victorious and win support amongst demographics that Republicans have traditionally had trouble with.
Madrid says the campaign of San Diego Mayor-elect Kevin Faulkner provides a roadmap for other GOP candidates. Faulkner ran a moderate campaign and made efforts to appeal to Hispanic voters. He ended up winning by a 10-point margin, larger than the polls predicted. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
The California legislature is considering a bill that would allow 16-year-olds to pre-register to vote. Under the bill, participants would automatically be registered to vote on their 18th birthday. Democratic State Senator Hannah Beth Jackson says her bill would engage teenagers in the democratic process early.
They can hear the conversation, go, oh yeah, that's me. When I'm 18, I'm going to be voting just like them because I'm pre-registered. And I think it will give them a little more skin in the game, and that's the goal.
Jackson says people aged 18 to 24 are registering to vote at much lower levels than other age groups. She says pre-registration could be incorporated into high school civics courses. 13 other states allow registration before age 18. A recent study found pre-registration programs in Hawaii and Florida encourage young people to start voting and keep voting. This is Valley Public Radio News.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. President Obama was on the ground in the Valley for only around 3 hours on Friday. But after making stops to meet with local ag and water leaders in Firebaugh and touring a farm with fallowed cantaloupe fields in Los Banos, many are hoping for big changes in the near future when it comes to federal involvement in California's water situation and the current drought. Here to analyze the president's visit and what it might mean for the future of the Valley, we're joined by two political science professors from Fresno State, Jeff Cummins, who joins us in our studio. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start out here and talk about this situation and what we saw on Friday. Quite an impressive scene with any president, thus using the majesty of the office. There's nothing quite like Air Force One flying in and touching down and Marine One taking off. That is a political statement itself, is it not?
Yeah, it's quite a spectacle, all the entourage that comes with the president anywhere he goes. And I guess we should be pretty pleased that he found time in his schedule to come out and see what the situation was like here on the ground. But ultimately, you know, we're kind of it's up in the air as to what it'll actually mean in terms of legislation and ultimately funding to provide some of the relief for the drought.
Yes, indeed. And the president acknowledged that California's water politics, the situation there is very complicated. He said he doesn't intend to wade into this because he wanted to get out alive on Valentine's Day. But he did say that he wanted to see a different sort of future beyond the business as usual approach.
You know, one of the great things about that town hall that I just came out of, not everybody agreed on anything. except people did agree that we can't keep on doing business as usual.
Now, that is a very interesting statement. The president met with local ag leaders, folks from different water districts, the Bureau of Reclamation. Also, one environmental group, the NRDC, was there. Certainly, there are other folks who weren't at the table at the event on Firebaugh, folks north of the Delta, folks who are farmers up in the area in Northern California who are concerned about water loss, trying to move on beyond business as usual. That's been a challenge for just about everyone since the mid-1960s who's tried to do anything in California, water politics. The chances of something like that coming out of this situation?
Pretty slim. Obviously, his staff had briefed him on the messy situation that's been going on here really for decades. If we go back to the 1980s and the peripheral canal ballot proposition. But the president's job is to be optimistic and try and work out some of these solutions. You know, he's coming up to the end of his term and administration. And, you know, it's pretty unlikely that any sort of major national solution will come.
Let's bring into the conversation now Professor Tom Holyoke, who joins us now on the phone. Tom, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, Tom. Your thoughts on the president's visit last week. Why now, and what do you think he really hoped to accomplish?
Well, why now? Because a great deal of pressure has been put on Democrats by some of the local Republicans, especially with the legislation passed recently in the House by Congressman Valadao, Congressman Nunes, Congressman McCarthy, and we had the big press conference out here with House Speaker John Boehner. The passage of that legislation basically means that shows that the House is doing something, even though it's something of a divisive bill, but that puts pressure on the Senate to also step up and do something, and senators responded. Senator Feinstein, Senator Boxer, and a couple of senators from Oregon introduced legislation, which we presume will pass the Senate. It's a very different kind of legislation. Once that passes, and there's possibility for what we call a conference committee, an attempt to reconcile bills and negotiate before anything is sent to the president, whether negotiations are actually possible or not. I mean, these two bills are miles apart. So I don't know if negotiations can succeed in actually producing meaningful legislation before the summer's over.
Yes, indeed. One thing that the president has tried to do is paint this not just as a California issue, but as a national issue and something of concern to folks across the country.
California is our biggest economy. California is our biggest agricultural producer. So what happens here matters to every working American, right down to the cost of food that you put on your table.
Now, that brings up an interesting point. The Senate bill calls for $300 million in aid. The House bill calls for removal of restrictions on pumping and things like that, the environmental restrictions. Tom, what do you think about the chances of a bill moving forward in conference, whether it's that Senate bill? It seems rather unlikely. Everyone in Washington says the House bill is dead on arrival. Those environmental rollbacks aren't popular in the Senate. What do you think California might get out of something, especially knowing that it has to be of interest to the whole country?
Well, I think the chances of actual legislation being passed are very small, simply because the two bills do vastly different things. The Senate bill really deals with the symptoms of the drought problem, making more money available to solve the greater problems of hunger it's going to result and unemployment. It does make it easier to move water from one state to another when there is water to be moved. But the Senate legislation specifically does not deal, as you say, with any of the environmental restrictions, whereas the House bill essentially eliminates most of the environmental restrictions, makes it easier to pump more water out of the Delta for the Valley. And the House legislation is more Valley-specific. The Senate legislation is more of a holistic view of California, which is another problem with reconciling them. Again, that's part of the reason I think the president was felt under pressure to come out here, because it's going to be easier for the president to do some things with executive authority rather than actually move legislation.
And turning to you, Jeff, one of the things that came out of this, you saw the responses from folks in the Republican Party. I want to talk about those in a little bit, at least Republican legislators in the House. But Valley ag interests had sort of a lukewarm response, depending on who you talk to. Some people were happy to see the president coming here. Others said, this isn't really a solution. We don't want a handout. We want water. That comes to the heart of the issue, though, is this short-term solution for this year versus a longer-term solution. Expectations are very high. Folks want to see some progress made in California in changing the way the state's water infrastructure works. But that's a multi-year, if not multi-decade process, even if you can get consensus. The president's trying to walk a fine line here between the short term and the long term, is he not?
Yeah, I think definitely he is, and but certainly with disaster politics, and by that I mean that here we have a natural disaster with the drought, similar to a hurricane or to a major storm. Presidents have an incentive to try and appear as responsive as possible to these types of problems. They tend to be more bipartisan in that, not necessarily the solutions, but most people agree that it's a problem that that is mostly out of our hands, and that it's the lack of rainfall that is the major contributor to it. So the president wants to be seen as responsive and facing the reality of the situation that there are no short-term solutions to providing more water. All he can do in the short term is to try and provide some relief to more of the immediate effects of the drought, and trying to provide more food, more relief for those who are unemployed and affected by the lack of agricultural production.
Now, the president didn't go too far out on any one limb, and talking about other things beyond the administration's proposal of several hundred million dollars in disaster relief and other federal directives to ease certain restrictions and order federal agencies to use less water. But one thing that was interesting, on Thursday there was a conference call with Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack and the White House's Director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, Dr. John Holdren. And he said, a reporter asked him, does the administration support new reservoirs or more reservoirs in California? And he said, reservoirs aren't the problem in California. California has enough reservoirs. The problem is not enough water, not enough snow, not enough rain this year.
on the surface this year, yeah, water this year falling from the sky is the problem. But folks on both the Democrats and the Republicans, I think, would maybe, at least in the Valley, take issue with that statement, at least in a good portion of our state here. Your thoughts on that, and is the administration cognizant of the situation in California with regards to saving water in wet years and having enough to support agriculture and the environment?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting statement. And, you know, I think it's true, as you said, in this year, and that obviously we don't have much rainfall at all. But over the long term, I think most of the people who look closely at the issue realize that it's a storage issue, and so I think perhaps the administration and Obama's science advisor is obviously playing to the environmental lobby, since they're usually opposed to providing more storage, at least surface storage, and so I think they're just really sensitive right now going into the primary elections and then the general election about stirring up environmental opposition to any of their initiatives.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition, we're talking about the politics of the president's visit last Friday on our program with Fresno State political science professors Jeff Cummins and Tom Holyoke. One of the other things that the president did is link California's current situation to climate change. And let's hear what he had to say about that.
Droughts have obviously been a part of life out here west in the West since before any of us were around. And water politics in California have always been complicated. But scientific evidence shows that a changing climate is going to make them more intense. Scientists will debate whether a particular storm or drought reflects patterns of climate change. But one thing that is undeniable is that changing temperatures influence drought in at least three ways.
And the president went on to say those three ways include more rainfall and extreme downpours, meaning you can't capture it all in reservoirs. It goes out in flood channels. A change in the mix of precipitation between rain and snow, more rain, less snow, which allows us to store more water, and then more evaporation. Republicans have been very vocal, Tom, in saying that the drought is man-made, but they back away from this one quite a bit. But it does seem like the science is pretty well established that droughts like this and climate change, the impact can only increase their severity.
Well, global warming is coming to the point where it's coming to be an established scientific fact. Is it actually responsible for this particular drought? I've heard arguments spun both for and against. But because global warming's impact on California is predicted to be an actual increase in rain, not snow necessarily, but rain, this actually feeds into the argument for more storage, because there's going to be more rain and there's going to be more, you know, water in the rivers at specific points in time, and more storage would be able to capture that water and hold it for when we need it. Now, there's a lot of debate over what kind of storage you're going to want, whether it's best to build more reservoirs behind dams or actually do what's called water banking, putting water underground where it's safe from evaporation, but it's a little harder to corral and pump out. And that's really real political debate is on both storage and, to some extent, global warming.
Yeah, and that comment about global warming drew criticism from Valley Republicans. GOP whip in the House, Kevin McCarthy from Bakersfield, said the president's decision to use his visit to California as an opportunity to launch a massive spending initiative to explore impacts of climate change will simply leave California's Central Valley communities dry. Unfortunately, nothing the president does today or proposed today changes the underlying issue that our communities are not receiving the water they have contracted and paid for. That's a theme that a lot of Republicans, a lot of ag interests talk about. They say that they are paying for water under past agreements back in 1994 and the Bay Delta Accords. I always like that term, the Bay Delta Accords. It's almost like we had the Camp David process here in terms of a peace settlement that doesn't seem to be, in this case, working out very well. But again, we have this issue of both sides being very leery of the motives of the other and coming to some sort of a resolution. Do those past failures, such as the Bay Delta Plan and others, farmers thought they had given up something, and in exchange for giving up some water, they thought they had some certainty on future deliveries. Do those past failures make any future deal beyond this, the sort of executive action we saw Friday, even more challenging or even unlikely?
Well, yes, because nobody trusts anybody else anymore. I mean, 1992, farmers had to give up about 800,000 acre-feet of water in the Central Valley Project Improvement Act, and then ever since then, there's been a series of judicial decisions which have reduced pumping to save fish and therefore the fishing industry in the Delta, and now it's not entirely clear how much water their farmers, especially on the west side of the valley where they have junior water rights, it's from year to year, they can no longer be quite sure how much water they're going to get from the federal government or from the state government. And some years, like this one, they're going to probably get none at all. So as a consequence, no one trusts anybody anymore in this.
Yeah, and as the president said the other day, Jim Costa told him, if you want job security in California, be a water rights lawyer.
That's what I tell my students.
Probably very good advice indeed, especially considering the situation we're in right now. One other thing that I want to bring up, and Tom, I understand you have to go in just a moment,
yes,
that the president remarked about a situation. He actually evoked the last president to visit Los Banos, to my knowledge, and that's JFK, and his visit to the Valley in 1962 to talk about this, the groundbreaking of the San Luis Reservoir. Here's the president.
If we were able to do that then, we should be able to do it now. It's just a matter of us making sure that we're not putting politics ahead of trying to get things working.
1962 was a very different age. The Democratic Party in those days was was behind big infrastructure projects. We didn't have the types of environmental laws that we have both in California and nationally now. It was a different attitude back then. But in that era, you had Governor Brown's father, Pat Brown. You had JFK and others in Washington at the time supporting these sorts of projects. Is it interesting the president would evoke those the politics of that era to describe our future? Is he signaling a potential openness to a big infrastructure project to maybe do water storage?
I would say probably not. I think he was invoking that more of a time when, you know, Democrats and Republicans were, you know, in a better position to work together to solve the state's problems. No, I don't think the president's going to be endorsing the building of gigantic dams anywhere in the near future. Not only does that upset a lot of environmental interests, but I think there's a kind of a realization that the great dam building era is probably over and that there's more efficient ways of storing water, including ground banking. Although there might be something to be gained by raising the height of existing dams to increase storage capacity, but to build another gigantic dam, we haven't really built huge dams in the United States in the last, you know, 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, and of course the cost issue is a big one. Again, Tom Holyoke, thank you so much
for
joining us today. We're going to continue our conversation now with Jeff Cummins, and I want to turn to some more local things. Number one, the president did, for a very brief time, I think it was 155 seconds, meet with Mayor Ashley Swearingen of the city of Fresno. She was on the tarmac at the airport the other day waiting to talk to the mayor, and here is what the mayor had to say.
You know, it's amazing what happens when political will is marshaled, and I think as he turns his attention to this issue, it causes other things to fall into line. And I wouldn't be surprised to see that starting even as early as next week, as everyone gets the clear message that we need to do something about the drastic conditions in the West.
Are you talking about those?
Now, again, that was Mayor Ashley Swearingen of the city of Fresno just moments after talking with President Obama as he exited Air Force One with Jim Costa and Senators Boxer and Feinstein on Friday. That spectacle is kind of interesting, though. You have a Republican mayor in a city that has long been a bastion of Republican politics waiting on the tarmac for the president as he exits the plane. The mayor is no stranger to President Obama. She's been to Washington many times and has a number of federal grants to help the city out. Jeff, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the politics of that scene that we saw.
Well, I think certainly her efforts to try and develop a relationship with us with this administration have been fruitful. You know, as you mentioned, they have a federal official that's here in the Valley to help secure some of this federal grant funding. So I think that is a definite plus for our region. In terms of the politics of it, it's not that uncommon for Republican mayors in large urban areas facing a lot of the problems that have traditionally Democratic solutions to them, with unemployment and welfare issues, social welfare issues, those types of things. And you know, as a mayor of the city, she is just trying to put her best foot forward and get the president's support on some of these issues. And so, as I said, I don't think it's that uncommon for Republican mayors on the local level, right? Definitely less likely to see this at the state level. We've seen, you know, for instance, with the rollout of Obamacare, a number of Republican governors who have rejected the Medicaid expansion. So less likely to occur on the state level, more likely to occur at the local level. When these Republican mayors are dealing with some of these urban issues.
Now, speaking of other issues, that was one thing the mayor wanted to bring across and convey to the president as he visited the Valley. One was very obvious. The haze at the airport was very bad on Friday. Air pollution is certainly a big issue, but there's others as well.
Visit to our city and to our region. I wanted to make sure that he knew how grateful we are, that he's paying close attention to this issue, but I also wanted to make sure that he understands we have chronic long-term challenges in Fresno and in the Valley. And even in years of full water allocation, which doesn't happen very often, we have among the highest concentration of poverty, some of the lowest educational attainment, and the highest levels of unemployment. These are chronic issues that also have to be addressed along with the drought issues.
The mayor has been a vocal supporter of trying to find federal dollars to help in a number of these areas. She has received a good bit of funding for things like bus rapid transit, this $50 million federal and state funded program to build a high-speed bus line in Fresno, the $16 million to take out the Fulton Mall downtown and put Fulton Street back in place in the city's central business district. She is facing some opposition from spending that federal money, though, from folks at the city council who quite often are to the right of the mayor and say America is, in their words, broke. We're borrowing money from other countries to pay for these expenditures. We don't want to do that, even if it would help our city. The mayor is kind of in an interesting political stance right now. Does she really have a constituency at City Hall to bring some of these things forward and some of these things that maybe are in her opponent's mind tainted by the Obama administration's endorsement?
Well, I mean, I think the issue, you know, if we're talking about bus rapid transit, that is a partisan issue in that there's redistribution involved, where you're using public funds to try and help out middle and lower classes to provide transportation to them. So it's a partisan issue, and this, you know, kind of goes back to what we were talking about with the mayor developing a relationship with a Democratic administration, and that the urban issues that these mayors deal with are traditional Democratic issues. And so we see this partisan split. I think she does have a constituency in City Hall. It's just, you know, is it going to be enough to get the votes on the city council? We saw the 4-3 breakdown with the city council vote. And I don't think the issue is dead. And several of the opposing city council members indicated this. They weren't comfortable with the numbers as it was written up. I was somewhat surprised at the strategy of the mayor. Usually, if you're going to bring what I think is a pretty important initiative and one that kind of goes along with the revitalization of the downtown, that you would line up the votes and make sure that you had the votes to get it through, so that you didn't have to come back again and redebate it, and perhaps try and get some of the public groups behind her. And have them more line, kind of have her ducks lined up more in a row before bringing that initiative to the council.
We have just a few seconds left before we go. The other issues, things like air quality, unemployment, any possibility do you think that the president's visit means that we might see other attention to this area in the future for other things beyond the water situation here in California? Folks have wanted the president to visit Fresno and the central part of the San Joaquin Valley for some time. Do you see any new attention, do you think, in Washington for our issues here?
I doubt it. You know, here we are several years out of the Great Recession, and you know, Fresno is one of those areas. Fresno in the larger region is one of those areas that has been largely left behind in the recovery. I don't see anything major. Perhaps, you know, as we've talked about, we might see some more federal grants come our way, but no major initiatives. And I was, you know, somewhat disappointed with the president's visit and that he didn't take the time to address some of these larger issues that are afflicting our valley, and really only concentrated on the drought situation.
Again, Fresno State political science professor Jeff Cummins joining us today on Valley Edition, talking about President Obama's visit to the valley on Friday. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. You've heard all about the expansion of coverage under Obamacare and when it comes to Covered California and the insurance exchange, but what about the Medi-Cal expansion? How is it going here in the valley? Our Rebecca Plevent reports in just a moment. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We've heard a lot about the troubled rollout of the federal health care law. There were those problems with healthcare.gov, and there were numerous customer service issues with Covered California. But less publicized are the challenges facing the newly expanded Medi-Cal program. As FM 89 reporter Rebecca Plevin tells us, Fresno County officials and community groups are tackling the daunting task of enrolling tens of thousands of people into the state's Medi-Cal program.
In a cramped cubicle in the Sunnyside neighborhood of Fresno County, Nang Yang is playing a small role in the country's healthcare overhaul. Yang is a certified enrollment counselor at Fresno Center for New Americans, a group that works primarily with the Southeast Asian community. On this afternoon, she's helping a Hmong woman enroll in Medi-Cal.
And she preferred to be in English so that her daughter can read to her because she don't read and write in Hmong, and sometimes the translation gets lost when the information is sent to her in Hmong.
Since enrollment kicked off October 1st, Yang and her team have enrolled about 500 people into Medi-Cal. They're one of a number of groups helping to sign people up. It hasn't been easy. At Fresno Center for New Americans, there's a week-long wait to get an appointment with an enrollment counselor. The counselors only see about 6 people per day.
It's overwhelming, but it's also a really good feeling knowing that those people that don't have coverage are getting covered.
Throughout Fresno County, those involved in Medi-Cal enrollment say the process has been stressful but steady. One by one, and in a spectrum of languages, they've enrolled people at community group offices, public events, in rural communities, and even parole offices. About half of the county's 56,000 Medi-Cal-eligible residents had enrolled in the program by the end of last year. That's according to the County Department of Social Services. But enrollment is just one hurdle in this long process. Looking forward, there are questions about how tens of thousands of people, many of whom have never had insurance, will learn to navigate the complicated healthcare system. And looking back, there are questions about whether this process could have been easier if the Fresno County Board of Supervisors had not turned down millions of federal dollars to establish a program to enroll the poorest people into insurance earlier. Kevin Hamilton is the Deputy Chief of Programs for Clinica Sierra Vista.
There are people who have literally lost limbs, lost their sight, had heart attacks, who would not have had that happen to them if the county had gone for the low-income health program.
The program, which was considered a bridge to Medi-Cal, would have allowed the county to get a jump start at enrolling thousands of the most vulnerable people into insurance. They would have been transitioned into Medi-Cal on January 1st. Instead, county officials and agencies are playing catch-up now during Medi-Cal enrollment, Hamilton says.
It has gone so much more smoothly in other counties where these patients were transferred by the state in a very smooth fashion. It went so well, I was so surprised.
Others say it's not worth looking back at the low-income health program when there are still so many more people to enroll and applications to process. Sonia Bouguet is a deputy director of the County Department of Social Services.
50% 3 months into it is a huge accomplishment given the statewide numbers of how many people need to enroll and where we're at. So I don't know that it would have made a huge amount of difference, but we're kind of going, okay, woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Whenever people are enrolled into Medi-Cal, the next question is, does expanded access to health care translate to expanded use of preventative health care services? Not necessarily, says Kevin Hamilton of Clinica Sierra Vista.
When somebody is sick is not the best time for them to learn.
He says teaching people to use their new Medi-Cal insurance to seek preventative health care instead of relying on the emergency room in a pinch will require generational shifts. He envisions classes on navigating the healthcare system incorporated into school curriculums and workshops offered by local community groups.
I'd love to see, and I'd love to be referring my patients to one of the local community-based organizations for their, so you got health insurance now, what next, classes, you know, where they're going to have pizza for lunch and healthy pizza, of course. They're going to learn all about this and bring the family.
At Centro La Familia in southwest Fresno, enrollment counselors like Cindy Avila are beginning to do that on an individual basis. She will follow up with her newly insured clients to make sure they visit a doctor before they ever get sick.
We keep checking on them until they make their first appointment. And we get them to get the first appointment, and then we'll check on them within 6 months.
If all 56,000 people enroll in Medi-Cal and learn how to utilize their insurance, will there be enough doctors to see them? The Central Valley already has a chronic shortage of primary care doctors and specialists. David Palmaville, interim director of the County Health Department, says that's a concern for down the line.
Right now, I think the focus is on trying to get as many individuals into the system as we can.
But Hamilton of Clinica Sierra Vista says it's an immediate problem. His network of federally qualified health centers has been swamped with people who are eager to finally see a doctor.
It's busier than it's ever been. I mean, we've always been busy, but now it's getting a little ridiculous.
Those on the ground say the challenges become worthwhile when they see how relieved people are to finally have health insurance. Back at the Center for New Americans, Nang Yang lights up as she tells the story of one happy client.
He brought in some fruits and vegetables and said, you know what, I don't have anything, but this is like for you and for the staff.
She becomes more serious as she explains that his reaction is motivation to push forward.
This is the reason why we work so hard. It's not so much for the money, but it's so much to help people out. Because all this time, you know, some of them don't know the system. They don't know how to access the system or access healthcare. And that's why we're here.
The deadline to enroll in insurance plans through Covered California, the state's insurance exchange, is March 31st. Medi-Cal enrollment continues through the end of the year. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
And Rebecca Plevin joins us now in our studio. Rebecca, that was a really powerful story and a powerful quote from Kevin Hamilton talking about Fresno County's lack of the bridge to Medi-Cal, the low-income health program. The county turned down around $50 million. Could have been more, could have been less. But it was a proposal that many counties, in fact, most in the state, took advantage of. And he said folks lost limbs, had heart attacks because that wouldn't have happened if the county had accepted that federal grant.
That's right.
How has the lack of that MISP program or the low-income health program, rather, how has that MISP is actually something different. How has the lack of the low-income health program affected the Medi-Cal enrollment situation in Fresno?
Right. Thank you. So what I have been told is that there are about 19,000 people in the county's medically indigent safety net program. So these are 19,000 people who would have been eligible for that low-income health program if they had implemented it, but instead were in this safety net program for the medically indigent. So
yeah, and the MISP program is the one that the county has through community hospitals, and it provides indigent care right now.
Exactly.
It may be going away. We'll see. That's another story for another week on our show. But go
exactly.
Ahead.
Exactly. So those 19,000 people, what they say is about 5,000 that might be undocumented. So say you have 14,000, 15,000 people. They could have been moved into the low-income health program, which was a bridge to Medi-Cal earlier. And so then on, you know, January 1st, 2014, they could have been seamlessly moved into the Medi-Cal insurance program that we have now. And what that would have done is it would have moved 15,000 people, 14,000 people over earlier, so that now when you have people like Nang Yang, who we heard on the show, who's trying to enroll people in Medi-Cal, that would have been 14,000, 15,000 people who were already in Medi-Cal and off the rolls that are trying to get access to medical care insurance now.
You mentioned that one of the challenges that groups in the county face right now is this lack of enrollment folks, the folks who are doing enrollment. How are these community groups dealing with this? Are they being paid by the county, paid by the state, paid by the feds? How does this work?
Right. So what I understand is that these community groups probably got some grant money to get a certain number of people. Actually, I don't know if they got grant money or not, but they had a certain number of people who were trained. They had to go to these Covered California courses, and they were trained to certify people for insurance. And now the groups get paid $50 per enrollment sign up. And so it doesn't matter if it takes 10 minutes or an hour because it's a big family. They get paid $58. And so I think that might make it harder for them to, you know, get more people on from their staff to start doing enrollment because there's not a lot of money for it.
Now, one of the other things that I've heard people say is Fresno County got this 50% number, but those were the low-hanging fruit. Is there a concern that maybe that's going to slow down 3 months, 50%? Is that pace going to be able to continue, or are we going to see some changes there, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know that the county is saying right now that until they get 100% enrollment, they won't be successful. Sonia Bouquet, who we heard in the report, wants to reach 100% enrollment. And that will probably take even more outreach, more education to reach people who are still wary of this, who are still learning about it. It's going to take a lot of outreach and enrollment. And people are doing that now on the ground, but it's going to take a lot of work still.
Again, Valley Public Radio's healthcare reporter Rebecca Plevin joining us today on the Medi-Cal expansion. Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. California may be a bastion of the Democratic Party these days, but one outspoken conservative lawmaker wants to change that. Capitol reporter Katie Orr took a ride with the Tea Party candidate hoping to become California's next governor.
Knock on the door of Tim Donnelly's brightly painted Liberty Express, and the candidate himself might open it for you.
Hi.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
The inside of the RV turned campaign bus is a bit cramped. On this day, Assemblyman Donnelly, a Tea Party Republican from San Bernardino, sits at a small table. He's making fundraising calls.
Hey, Larry, how are you? Oh, really? Wow.
This is no deluxe operation. This is campaigning for governor on a budget. At the end of 2013, Donnelly's campaign had just over $54,000 cash on hand. Governor Jerry Brown had nearly $17 million. Donnelly insists money isn't everything.
Ask Meg Whitman. She had $170 million. Jerry Brown beat her.
Still, Donnelly knows he needs some money to keep his campaign going. So while on the road to a fundraising event, Donnelly directs his staff to make a last-minute detour to meet with donor Deborah Massey. She says Donnelly represents her principles.
He believes in freedom for people and liberty. He believes in less government, and he does not compromise.
While getting a private tour of Donnelly's bus, Massey asks for a moment of prayer.
You will be glorified in it and in all things that will work out well. Thank you, dear. In Jesus' name, amen.
It's those kinds of personal connections Donnelly is counting on to propel him through the election. He isn't likely to get much support from his party. Donnelly's ultra-conservative reputation is a turnoff to many of his Republican colleagues. Assembly Leader Connie Conway offers faint praise.
Donnelly's been out there for a while. I mean, I think this has been important to him, and he's working hard every day, and we'll see whether all that hard work pays off for him or not.
Donnelly first gained attention as the founder of a Minuteman chapter that camped out at the California-Mexico border in protest of illegal immigration. In 2012, he was sentenced to 3 years probation after bringing a loaded gun into an airport. In recent months, he's generated buzz with a series of off-the-wall videos his campaign has produced.
We need to make California the sexiest place to do business. Because right now, the only thing sexy to me in the state of California is my wife.
Republican political consultant Mike Madrid says such tactics may get Donnelly past the primary, but not much further.
I think he believes a lot of what he's conveying, and I think there's probably a lot of truth in some of what he's saying. But I think the tone and the PR, which is a very big part of politics, the presentation, I don't think sits well with modern-day California.
Donnelly brushes off the lack of state and national party support.
I don't know of a single consultant in the state of California that could win an election here statewide. Where are they? That would be my question to them. And as far as the National Party, who cares? The National Party is never going to help California.
Donnelly found a like-minded crowd when his bus finally arrived at the Sutter County Republican Central Committee meeting. His speech was greeted with head nods and clapping, and at the end, he received a standing ovation. Physician Jay Grissel says Donnelly's message of less government regulation resonated with him.
This morning I sat in a meeting for 2 hours and we did nothing but talk about what regulators wanted us to do. It had nothing to do with patient care. And that's why I support somebody like Tim.
But banker Liesl Schmidt worries Donnelly might be promising too much.
When you're talking about immigration and not giving amnesty and all of that, I think that's going to be really, really difficult to get approved in the state. And so I think you have to pick your battles.
And Donnelly is risking a lot on his battle to be governor. If he loses, he'll also be out of the assembly. But he says what's at stake for California is more important than whether he has a job next year. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
California's drought has led to fishing bans on parts of the American and Russian rivers. The State Fish and Game Commission approved the closures in an attempt to protect threatened salmon and steelhead trout. Bans are already in place in dozens of streams and rivers in the Central Coast. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, scientists are worried the drought may push one particular species toward extinction.
Eric Larson, a fish biologist with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, stands on a cliff overlooking the ocean in Pescadero. This is where water flows from Pescadero Creek into the ocean. At least it normally would this time of year. Instead, Larson points to a sandbar.
Because there's no flow in the river, there's not enough counterforce to keep the sandbar open. And so you have a closed system when you would normally have an open system, which does not allow for fish to come in and spawn.
The drought has caused sandbars to block almost all the creeks from Golden Gate to Monterey Bay, stranding fish that normally move upriver to prime spawning areas. Larson says a particular concern is the fate of the endangered Central Coast coho salmon. He says their populations are crashing.
It's extremely low. It's at risk of extinction. It's listed both by the state and the federal government as threatened and or endangered, and it's in critical state. So a loss of a year like this has a dramatic impact on its life cycle.
Wild coho were once abundant enough to support a commercial fishery, but now they can't be fished even recreationally. Threatened steelhead trout are also waiting offshore at the same streams. Larson says there's not a lot the department can do, even if biologists were to physically breach the sandbars. To understand why, he takes me upstream, where just a small trickle of water flows.
We're standing on the river bed that is dry next to the remaining flow in the system. It's a greatly reduced flow. This would normally be winter flow conditions, and we'd be standing in water now under normal rainy years.
Normally, water flows at about 30 to 40 cubic feet per second here. Earlier this week, it was less than 1 cubic foot. That's not enough flowing water for a fish to spawn, even if it makes it past a sandbar. Fisheries biologist Stafford Lair with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife says the drought is posing more of a risk to fish in this area than in any other part of the state. He studied the coho salmon population in the area in the 1980s.
Never thought that we would be where we're at today because there were still fish there. We could still study them. Now it's tough to find them.
At a Fish and Game Commission meeting Wednesday, Lair urged fishing bans on coastal streams west of Highway 1 from San Mateo to San Luis Obispo counties. He had also requested fishing bans on parts of the American and Russian rivers, which the commission unanimously approved.
All projected water flow situations as we look forward
It's only going to get worse for the fish in the system.
He says mortality from angling is small, but in this drought with such small populations, every little bit helps. None of the anglers who spoke at the meeting opposed the closures. John McManus with the Golden Gate Salmon Association is worried about commercial hatchery salmon. He wants the department to truck salmon to the ocean so they can avoid what he called horrific drought conditions in the rivers.
To us, what we're talking about actually is the impacts not only on one of California's natural resources, the salmon fishery, but also on tens of thousands of jobs that are related to the salmon fishery that hang in the balance right now, depending upon actions taken to conserve and preserve salmon.
The commercial salmon industry shut down in 2009 because of the dry years that preceded it. McManus fears that could happen again. The Fish and Game Commission approved the fishing bans until April 30th. They're the broadest drought-related fishing bans the state has ever seen. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Long before stars like Meryl Streep and Leonardo DiCaprio, Hollywood screens were graced by icons like Gloria Swanson, Mary Pickford, and Douglas Fairbanks. While you can watch their movies online and on DVD today, it's a rare opportunity to see their silent films on the big screen in the way that generations nearly 90 years ago did. But that's exactly what you can do in Fresno now, thanks to a new silent film series at Fresno's landmark movie palace, the Warner's Theater. Here to tell us more about the silent film series is Michelle Swift, who is the program coordinator for the Warner Center for the Performing Arts. Michelle, welcome.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this program that you have of silent films. It's been going on now for a number of months, and you have a film coming up on Thursday.
We do. We're doing Pollyanna with Mary Pickford. We're also going to show a couple of their other shorts, The Narrow Road and What Drink Did.
What is it like? What's the experience like, especially for most of our audience probably hasn't been to a movie palace to see a silent film? It's not just sitting in a dark room with no sound. It's actually quite a lively and quite an auditory experience, is it not?
Absolutely. They used to make it a big experience to go out to the movies. You know, back in the day, it was you put on your Sunday best, you wore all your furs, you got really dressed up. And we've tried to make it not just a movie viewing experience, but actually like a time travel experience. You walk into the theater, and first of all, if you've never been into Warner's Theater, it really is like taking a step back into time. But we also have volunteers who wear 1920s costumes, and we encourage guests to dress up in 1920s costumes. So it gives you a real feel for the time frame.
Now I have to ask, what brought you into this situation? What made you interested in being involved in something like this? You're a young person. Why silent films?
Our previous executive director had the idea, and we thought, wow, what if we could bring people into the theater and give them the kind of experience they would have had in 1920, give them something to really connect them to the theater and make them feel like they've stepped back in time and appreciate this old building.
Now, tell me a little more about what this is like. You have this film, Pollyanna, featuring Mary Pickford. What's it like watching these old silent films for folks who are used to modern cinema? The acting is different. The style is different. But why do you find it so interesting?
Well, some things are funny that they probably didn't intend to be hilarious when they first wrote it, simply because the acting is different and et cetera. When you first sit down, the screen starts playing, and up from this organ pit on a hydraulic lift rises the organist in this big grand entrance playing his opening number. And then he sinks back down into the organ pit, so he's not in the way of the screen, and starts playing a soundtrack. And the organ that we have is a Robert Morton pipe organ. It was intended for silent films. It has sound effects. It can replicate any instrument in the orchestra. But when he's doing his job properly, and our organists do, you can't even tell that they're there because they're simply playing a soundtrack for the film.
Yes, indeed. Now, this film is coming up on Thursday evening at 7 p.m. at the Warner's Theater. You also have two shorts that are playing before this film.
We do, and I'm not positive if you plan on playing the shorts before or after.
Or after, okay. Well,
but either way, yeah. The Pollyanna should be about an hour long, and the shorts are in between like 10 and 15 minutes each. We're playing The Narrow Road and What Drink Did, in addition to Pollyanna.
Now, what has the response been from the community like? Who comes out to these sorts of events? Is it folks who are cinema buffs? Is it folks who like dressing up in 1920s wear? What's the response been like from the community?
You know, we have a really wide, diverse array of people who come out. You would think that it might just be older people, people who might, you know, have seen some of these films when they were younger. But we have people who bring their children out to see it. We have students from film classes at Fresno City and Fresno State that come out. Children, parents, grandparents. It's great hearing the stories from multiple generations of, oh, I remember Warner's Theater. I came to see Sinbad here in 19-whatever. Oh, it's really good to see.
Yeah, definitely. It's a great. Again, Michelle Swift from the Warner Center for the Performing Arts joins us on Valley Edition today. Now, Michelle, it's not just on this Thursday night that the Warners is doing things. You have a number of events throughout the year. You do art hop tours, all sorts of different concerts at the different venues, including the Star Palace and Frank's Place. Folks really feel passionate about this theater. It's on the National Register of Historic Places, built in 1928 by Mr. Pantages, who is a Hollywood mogul himself. What is that experience like, going on one of these tours of the Warners and the response from the community?
Tours are really, really fun for me to get to do and for the volunteer docents to get to do, because many, many times people have never been in the theater before, even if they spent their entire life in Fresno. So it's kind of like getting to see the theater through someone else's eyes, because I've been with the theater for a number of years now. So every art hop, I get to review it with a brand new lens.
And it's not just an experience that you see. It's not just an experience you hear. When the Robert Morton organ is going, you actually feel that thing in the
Absolutely.
Theater.
Absolutely. I say that when you're down in the dressing room area and the organ starts playing, sometimes it sounds like the voice of God.
Yes, indeed. Again, we're looking forward to it. Again, it's coming up this Thursday evening at 7 p.m. Pollyanna, and you said this is starring Mary Pickford.
It is, and I've seen a couple of the shorts, and it looks really quirky. Very fun.
We definitely are looking forward to that. See, one of the stars of the golden age of Hollywood back on the silver screen in one of the nation's most impressive 1920s era movie palaces, Fresno's Warner's Theater. Again, it's the series that takes place on Thursdays. Is it every month?
These are the last two films of our series, this Thursday, Pollyanna, and then next month for Art Hop, instead of doing our normal tours we're going to show our last silent film, The Lost World. We were hoping to capture a larger audience if we do it during Art Hop. And then those who stay after the film on March the 6th, they're going to get to have a tour as well.
Great. Well, we hope that the series will continue, and we look forward to seeing all the great events taking place at the Warner's Theater. Again, Michelle Swift, the program coordinator for the Warner's Center for the Performing Arts, talking about the silent film series, which again continues this Thursday night at 7 p.m. with Mary Pickford in Pollyanna. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
For sure. Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can follow us online, kvpr.org, for podcasts and more information. Here's some of the stories that you heard on today's program. See pictures and more, again, online at kvpr.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at kvpr.org and email us, talk@kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, reporter Rebecca Plevin, audio production engineer Marv Allen, and production manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.